Riddle, and this is the Nat Life Pod, a platform for conversation to help close the gap between wellness as an industry and wellness as a state of being. Big shout out to this episode's sponsor, XL Coffee. XL are renowned organic coffee producers here in the UK who have gone to extraordinary lengths to ensure their coffee is mold-free and has kept its antioxidant potency. XL are waking up the world of coffee. I'm a big fan and recommend you go give them a try. Use discount code NatLifePod at checkout. Details are in the show notes. On this week's episode of the NatLife Pod, I'm behind the mic with Seth Hughes. Or for those that know him, you're from here. Seth is a super inspiring human who's on a mission to help others reconnect to being nature, not separate from it. Led by curiosity, a talent for filmmaking, foraging, and a little frustration, Seth decided to get a smartphone and start communicating his message for both personal and planetary health. And in just 5 months, went from zero to hero with 124,000 followers on the gram. Now I say hero, not because he hit 124,000 followers, but because of his love and care and the intention behind what he chooses to share with his growing community. Seth produces really meaningful, insightful, healing content. We unpack his journey from his early years as a surfer and his transition to a successful young videographer on the surf scene, and how nature has helped him remain grounded whilst navigating these new times as a 24-year-old man being catapulted from Seth wanting to help others reconnect to the land to Seth going viral with reels hitting 5 million views. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as we did. Seth.
Tony, hello.
Welcome. Welcome to the Nat Life Pod.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. Great to have you here. It's not far for you, of course, being up the road. Great to know you're just local. The first time we met, it took some time, right? Back and forth, WhatsApping. It was a busy time. Well, it was a busy time for me. There was a lot happening. And then something dropped in recently, and it was your Instagram account. And I didn't connect that was you that Porth Town. Seeing it, even watching the clips that you'd put up, I mean, one of them's like major kind of engagement. I think you've got like 5 million on one of those reels right now.
Yeah.
Which we can get to, we can unpack that. But it was like, we'd then messaged and I said, oh, here's my WhatsApp, here's my number. And then when your message came through, I could then see the stream of messages. Oh my God, that's Seth. I can't believe that's the same guy.
I hadn't realized you hadn't connected the dots.
No, I hadn't
that's
at
so
all.
Funny.
It was so interesting.
Yeah.
It was a very crazy time for me. But I guess you might be getting hit with that right now, with that engagement going up. And it seems like quite a short window of time that. We spoke of it the other day. It's like, what are we, 6 months into starting your Instagram?
Started in
account?
May. May, June, July, August, September. Yeah, 5 months.
5 months.
Yeah.
And like rocketing like that.
And it was February, wasn't it, that we met up for that morning, I think.
Yeah, it was meant to be much earlier than that. I think it was the year before, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was funny to think that the last time that I'd seen you was before, like, starting an account like that was even on my radar. And then basically kind of got a message a few months after starting the account saying that you kind of come on the podcast, you know?
So
it's quite a funny full circle moment, because kind of a year prior I had listened to you on the Rich Roll podcast, and that had sent me off in a kind of a particular journey, you know.
That
and
podcast keeps giving.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And like, listened to it with my whole family in the car, and like, they kind of all love it, you know. And
that's good to hear.
So it's like fantastic for this kind of to have come full circle, you know, to feel like I'm, I don't know, just to be privileged to be around people like yourself who don't live far down the road, who are paving the way for a lot of younger people, you know. So just thank you for that.
Well, you're in the paving of the way now, right? That's what's nice. But it's also nice, we were speaking in the kitchen earlier about community, right? And those unique gifts and talents, and there's certainly a unique gift and talent there of yours. Because it's not just about making reels, there's a skill set within that, right? So there's Seth the forager, there's Seth the videographer. When did the videographer kind of photographer drop in for you? When did that start?
That started when I was probably 16 or 17. Like my kind of first love was surfing. Like I'm a surfer first. And I was living, I grew up in London and
Where were you surfing?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. We were my mum was taking me, and my mum and dad were taking me various weekends to do competitions and training and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I had like a little surf kind of crew, and a lot of that was down here. A lot of it was actually at the like beaches right here, you know. Mm. And it kind of that got me into my first love, really. That became obsessive for me in my teenage years. And then when I was 16, my mum decided to move to Cornwall and kind of relocated. She wanted to move, but definitely one of the reasons for coming down was also so I could kind of surf more, you know, and she could see that.
Kudos to mum.
Exactly. Yeah. It was like life changing for me. And she could see that I wasn't thriving in London so much. And she knew that probably she wasn't thriving in London so much. So it was kind of a move down here. But kind of all at the same time moving down, I realized that I also wasn't going to make it as like a pro surfer by any stretch. You know what I mean? Like I loved surfing, but that desire to be like like competing at that level really fell away. I didn't feel like I had a particularly strong competitive spirit compared to a lot of the other people my age.
Mm.
And I decided that that kind of wasn't for me, you know? And I think the year I moved down, maybe the year before, my granddad died and he was a photographer and I got a lot of his camera gear. Basically, I got all his old kind of 35mm film camera gear. And
so much more of it.
And so much more. And this kind of light bulb moment went off for me where I was like, I could film all like the wildlife near my house and I could film my mates going surfing and I could do all these things I could use. And I took all that camera gear, sold various bits of it to get my first kind of like DSLR video camera. And then I was away and I was like from a kind of, I guess, social media and like a bit of money way, I was filming my mates going surfing and with their sponsors and all of that. And then on the side, I was filming on the like estuaries and coasts in my house, like filming the egrets and the birds and the various things and making little documentaries myself. And then kind of one thing led to another. Once you get in the video, a lot of people who kind of grow up in the action sports world kind of find their way into videography, you know, because they realize maybe they don't want to compete or they want to still stay on the scene and travel, but they're not quite good enough to be competing at that level or something. And they pick up a camera instead just to kind of tag along. And that was definitely one of the stories for me.
Also, if you get a good gig, there's money behind that. So you can get to travel.
You get to travel and you get to surf and you get to go to these cool places.
You know, because I've had it where videographers have been in contact. Oh, I'd love to do this film. And there's part of it where you realize, oh, they'd like to do a film with you, but also they'd like to go and film in those locations. They'd like to travel with it, you know?
Totally. Well, that was the big one for me. Like I really wanted to travel and the camera was like a great excuse to be able to do that. And a lot of surf films for me at the time were the ones I was looking up to were ones from all around the world. And I wanted to kind of do that, you know?
So how did you connect with surf being in London? I mean, how did you connect with surfing? Was it through holidays originally?
My granddad had the granddad who died with the camera gear had a house in Bournemouth and we'd go there in the summer holidays.
Mm.
And I learned to surf at Boscombe there on the South Coast.
Quite a connection to granddad then.
Yeah, definitely quite a connection to granddad. And so a lot has kind of come off the back of his life and his death, you know? And that was one of the major catalysts. It was just a kind of a light bulb moment that like, oh, you could film stuff then. Like you could do, I hadn't even really thought about it before. Like suddenly this camera gear was just had arrived as some kind of inheritance. And I was like, oh my God, I could film those documentaries like I've watched growing up, like the wildlife documentaries. I could film my mates going surfing. And then it kind of opened up a whole kind of new world for me, you know.
Well, there's a curiosity there, isn't there? Exactly. You know, because you could easily be handed camera kit and go, oh, you know, look at this old stuff I've just been given.
Totally.
But there's an explorer beneath that, right?
Mm. Yeah, so that transitioned into me just filming and traveling and shooting stuff with mates. And then that got me through the surf angle, got me into commercials and from commercials assisting for directors and videographers and all these kind of people. And then I suddenly found myself like working on lots of video commercials for the last.
Well, you're a young guy now. I mean, how young are we talking now?
I'm 24.
Now. No, I mean, back then.
Then I got the, my granddad died when I was 16. And then by 17, I made my first paid surf film. And then, which looking back, still one of my favorite things I've made. And So seven years of working on like video commercials and filming surf and wildlife and stuff like that.
And lots of travel with the surfing. How's that? And
lots of travel with the surfing, yeah.
Yeah, where have you been? Where did you go?
Where have I been? Been to Hawaii a couple of times. Yeah. That's pretty good, yeah. Been to South Sumatra in Indonesia.
Look at Seth lighting up now. Look,
there you go. Yeah. But I kind of reached a point with a lot of that stuff where I just knew that the travel wasn't really what I wanted to do anymore. You know, like I wanted to set more roots at home. And this kind of much deeper desire of mine, which I thought was being fulfilled through travel, which was to really feel like an indigenous citizen of Earth. Like that itch was being scratched by traveling and making me feel like I was moving around.
A nomad.
Yeah, exactly. And now then I kind of transitioned being that I can scratch that itch a lot better rooting somewhere, you know, and I kind of became very British focused, very like kind of Celtic lands focused. And I just wanted to be here, you know, wherever that was, you know.
Yeah, with our own indigenous roots, right? Mm-hmm. I've had that through kind of the medicine work, and I often feel going to festivals, for instance, and we have this kind of indigenous theme, but there's not so much of the indigenous of our lands and connecting to that, you know, and the wisdom of our own lands. Mm-hmm. So really appreciate that. Yeah, that resonates.
It's coming though.
It really is. Yeah. You can feel it, right?
Mm-hmm. It's coming.
It's in the DNA, right? Yeah. It's already in the land. It's just it feels almost like it's a remembering for us, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And these platforms that we're on, social media, they get a bad rep. But actually, if you think about it, it's a great platform for connection and that remembering and reconnecting mm-hmm. with, you know?
Absolutely.
It feels like that.
Mm-hmm.
So then from surfing docs to having was there a big pause then in between? Because if you started that Instagram account, what, 6-5 months ago?
Yeah.
Between the last time you were filming and then, what was happening in that space?
That was the years where I was working on like commercial videos basically for all sorts of brands around the UK, around the world with a great team. And that's kind of what's seen me through my kind of young adulthood and until this point from like a work-wise, you know, from a work perspective. And then everything kind of changed quite quickly for me, and I really wanted to do something else, you know, and this reminder that like I was from these lands, that I was from this earth and all these kind of things that were like really started to set in for me, resulted in me really, I mean, lots of things did, but investigating local food and local wild food and foraging and learning the plants. I just suddenly felt like my duty. I had to know it. I couldn't, like, it was almost out of anger, you know? I couldn't believe no one had taught me. And I was like, I have to teach people.
Yeah, we have that with our kids because Katerina and I, at the very beginning when Lola dropped in, we were having these conversations about the supermarket, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And Lola would be at a certain age and it was always the brightly lit, packaged foods
mm-hmm.
that are so attractive and being put in specific areas within the supermarket and the scents and the smells, and then having to give children the skill sets to even navigate a supermarket and how we could then relate that to nature, you know, because even the most brightly colored attractive things aren't necessarily good for us in nature, right? And can be poisonous, detrimental to our health. And so there was that communication all along with us, with Lola, with foods, and then how much that we've lost and how many people just navigate a supermarket, just goes in the trolley and there's no skill there anymore. There's no real refinement of that understanding. Mm. So I feel the same. I think there's an element of, the language is like frustration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Frustration is, how comes we haven't been taught this?
Yeah.
How comes we went through this lengthy educational system and we come away with actually no life skills,
mm-hmm.
no skill sets, that if we removed all of this that we are sitting in right now and you had to return to the land, the basic fundamentals to survive, even our most basic needs, like building shelter, finding foods, where to locate water, where to even put your shelter,
mm-hmm.
we don't have any of that.
Exactly.
You know, just the most basic fundamental needs.
Mm.
Because we live again in a huge world of convenience, right?
Mm.
So I applaud you in what you're putting out there, because it's a great platform that you have there.
Mm.
And also coming from a 24-year-old.
Yeah.
And I say that with respect, because we spoke about this the other day. We went for a little trot.
Mm-hmm.
And I had friends, I think I must have been about 40. And we were discussing nature, and how is it that this isn't blowing up, that people mm-hmm. aren't so connected to this? And it was almost this language of it had to become a trend, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it almost has to be attractive enough, you know? So it's great to have kind of, I think what almost feels like this, I've spoken to it the other day, like almost like a baton. We hand over the baton now,
mm-hmm.
and there's younger voices coming through that are actually speaking to where it's at right now. Mm. I think that's so important, you know? Such value in what you're doing in that sense. So the foraging, yeah. When did that really kind of hit, and to the level of where you are now?
Didn't hit that long ago. Yeah, probably hit a year ago, realistically. I was very fortunate to have been brought up in a family that didn't necessarily have much like foraging knowledge, but had lots of knowledge of like the British landscape, the British bird, like birds were like the thing that I know more than any of these things, you know.
So were you a bird watcher or a twitcher?
Yeah, well, a bird watcher I would have said, but as a kid, probably a twitcher, really. Like, yeah. Had a bird list every day, what I saw on the walk to school, all these kind of things. And my dad and all his friends were like avid bird watchers, and I kind of grew up in that world and with this deep kind of appreciation, particularly for the like the British landscape, you know. And but I was never that interested in like plants, because the way I was taught that plants were, they're like boring, you know. So
yeah.
But animals are fun and plants are boring. That's largely what you're taught as a kid. And it kind of hit me that like just not that long ago that I wanted to learn about all these plants and trees in the same way that I taught myself to learn all the birds as a 10, 11, 12 year old. I was like, I could apply that same thing now to the kind of edible plants, but all plants. I didn't want to just know the edible ones. I wanted to know like all of them, you know, because having an understanding of the whole ecosystem that you're walking into. Now at the moment I'm doing a video about trees, like a much longer video about trees for YouTube, and how these, that they're like kind of, excuse the pun, like central pillars of an ecosystem to allow yourself to know where other things are that might be out of sight. You know, if I go, right, I'm looking for jelly ear mushrooms, they only grow on dead elder trees. Now I can scan that horizon on a bigger scale for dead elder trees and go, that's probably a jelly ear over there. But unless you know the bigger picture of that ecosystem, you're hunting for these tiny things that you want to eat, which are covered by other foliage and all these kind of things, you know? So I just decided that I didn't just want to know the birds. I didn't just want to know the edible things. I wanted to just kind of get a much bigger picture of the ecosystem at large, you know, and learn it intimately. I didn't really care about the names. The names are only important for this conversation, but the relationships between all those things is the thing that I wanted to really learn and make it feel like it was, I don't know, I don't want to say mine, but mine, you know, like I lived there, you know, I was had a deep relationship with each of these organisms, and that I went to the same places every day, you know, on the dog walks, picked the same thing, saw how those little environments I went to every day changed with the seasons. And I wanted to be as tuned into that as I don't know, like how I'd imagine kind of an indigenous Britain to be, a native Britain to be, in a kind of a more primitive way, you know.
And then there's the piece about becoming that landscape,
mm-hmm.
being nature as opposed to seeing yourselves outside that,
yeah,
which I guess speaks to that piece that Hanau has. It's insane, like 5 million views of a reel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I often think about that kind of indigenous piece. We have, I spoke to you about it. We have an apple tree here in the garden. And we're like, what's that tree in the garden? And there's a guy that comes, he looks after the land here. And he said, oh, that's an apple tree, but it hasn't had any apples on it. It was in the winter when we arrived here. And he said, I think he said 10 or 15 years since an old lady had the house and she died. And he said, there hasn't been any apples there. But the story's told that when children start playing beneath the tree, you'll have apples.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have an abundance of apples right now because our kids have been playing under it. But Katerina also said, you need to show the tree some love, you know? So that's what they've been doing.
Yeah.
And we have an abundance now of apples. Amazing. But it is that piece of connecting and having love, like love for the environment. But there's also tuning in. So I remember going, I was at 42 acres and we were foraging and we were looking for mushrooms. And the kids were kind of, and we couldn't find a thing. And it was like, hold on, we need to kind of calm into the environment now. And let's just breathe for a bit, slow things right down. And then almost becoming again that down-regulated human within the frequency of that environment. And then the senses opened. And then it was like, oh, they're fucking all around us.
Yeah.
That what we've been seeking is literally all around us. Mm. And I really think that's the piece for me. I've been on foraging experiences. And again, at 42 Acres, there's an amazing foraging expert there, Tasha. And she had attached to one of the retreats I was holding there. And we wanted to put together this foraging experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what we do is I'll take them for a sensory kind of opening experience first. We'll take them blindfolded into the woodland. And then we work on breathing. Oh, first of all, they're blindfolded and then they're holding on to each other's shoulders. So they're in a line.
Yeah.
The person at the front doesn't have a blindfold, don't worry. And then I walk them through the woodland. This is around a lake.
Yeah.
And then I take one from the back and it's a bit trippy for those that are like, oh my God, they've been taken.
Yeah. And they don't know that's going to happen.
And they don't know it's going to happen. Okay, yeah. And then I put them underneath a tree or wherever. They keep the blindfold on. Right? It's 100 cycles of breath, a bit like the breathing we started with this.
Mm-hmm.
So 4-6 tempo, microdose of LSD, low sleep, slow, light, slow, deep breath. And that just drops them right in. And then once they get to that, then they can take their blindfolds off and then they just open up that visual field. Mm-hmm. And then that, then their hearing's way in there because they've been blindfolded. Their sense of smell, all the other senses are heightened. Why is that important? Because we have a device in our hand that we're so hypervisual, which is sympathetic. That's like fight and flight. So it drops them right in. And then it's like, okay, find things in this location, 10 things that you can find and build something, you know, that it's either something to come back to. Build it with intention, set an intention while you're building it, or a gift to the woodland.
Mm-hmm.
And then I then handed them over to Tasha. And Tasha was going, oh my God, what a different group. I've never had a group like it. Because all their senses are open.
Yeah.
So they're just experiencing everything. And that's that indigenous piece, because there's a huge disconnect from going foraging in a huge rubberized piece of footwear.
Yeah.
On WhatsApp or something in your ears, or even just ruminating on something rather than being really down regulated and in that indigenous kind of vibration, I would say, you know?
Yeah, kind of swimming through it.
Yeah. And then you really get the peace where, you know,
particularly if you have that intention set as well, and then you've kind of, you know what you're kind of looking for.
Yeah. Why we're here.
Right? Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, even just from a particular plant. You know, that in setting the intention of the kind of plant that you're trying to find or the kind of mushroom you're trying to find, I think there's something there as well, you know.
Yeah.
It's like a clairvoyance type thing.
So with the foraging, when you first started, did you go through, like, how did it work for you? Were you like, I'm going to find five things? That's what I started. It was like, all right, I'm going to look for five things. I know those five things. That's what I'm going to look for.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I'm not going to be picking anything that perhaps is like, supermarket conversation where it could take me out.
Yeah. I was getting much more into it as the spring emerged, and I was almost watching each thing come out one by one. So I was just doing whatever was out, you know. And then I reached about like May, where suddenly there was loads of things out and it got a bit overwhelming. But it was almost just in the cycle that was coming out. It's like, oh, there's nettles now, and then there's Herb Robert, and now there's all these various other things that were kind of coming out in sequence, and kind of I would just, you know, as the spring's emerging from the winter, each flower or green plant that pops out kind of stands out like a sore thumb, really. So you kind of hone onto that.
Mm.
And I would just go, right, I haven't seen that this year yet, get my book, whatever. And at the time, I didn't have a smartphone, so I was just doing it with books, and so I didn't have any of the apps.
Books,
books, exactly, and or like YouTube videos were like a big one for me, you know. So I would like kind of bring a book with me, find out what it was, go back, and then research it on the internet and kind of cross-reference all those kind of things. And I just kind of build it up. Maybe one a week I did, and a plant a week. But that was felt like at the speed that things were coming out, things were growing in the spring. Yeah. And then once there was loads of stuff out, I just started picking whatever I thought looked cool, you know, more like learning about whatever I thought looked cool, you know.
Yeah. And there's moving with the seasons ourselves as well, right? Mm. How's the movement through a landscape for you? How do you, you know, have you kind of softened to the environment rather than the clump, crash, here comes a human?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I have softened to the environment. I navigate it in a very different way now. You know, so much of this started for me because for years I've been into like barefoot running effectively, you know, and all the same places that I run are all pretty much all the same places that I forage. Mm. And they kind of went hand in hand, you know. A lot of the initial things I'd pick on those runs barefoot, and they felt like they really, they just kind of shook each other's hands really well, you know. And there's also something to be said, I think, for like how foraging brings out that like kind of more primal movement in you, you know, because some things are high up and some things are low down. And some things are like deeper off the path. Some things you have to wade through water. Like there's all these various things that just by virtue of the fact that you're going out and harvesting and picking, you're doing all these things where you have to get low and squat and move around and maybe have to climb a tree or whatever it is. And you're kind of going through these ranges of motion that I actually hadn't done for years, not since I was a kid, you know? And there was a bit of resistance there initially. And now the resistance is gone because I know that it's like, oh, it's all part of the same thing. You know, that running and that moving and that foraging, all of it is like, it's all linked. And
yeah, if you think of the vocabulary of movement, so there might be crawling in there. Mm-hmm. There's low gait walking in there. Mm-hmm. Jumping, balancing, climbing, lifting.
Yeah, exactly.
Running.
Yeah.
Walking, swimming.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, first of all, there's like a rewilding of those, that resistance, because that could look like bending over.
Yeah, instead of squatting down.
Instead of squatting down.
And that was me, you know, initially, you know, until I realized I was like, these things were all like almost compartmentalized for maybe a couple of weeks. Didn't take long, but I was like, oh, wait, these all are the same. They all link up. Me going out into these more like, and then I hate saying things like going out into nature, but when you live in towns and cities, that is what it is. You go out into a different environment to what you're currently in. So going out into nature was like, didn't matter what I was doing there, it was still requiring the same motions from me. And I suddenly treated it in like a playful way, as opposed to like, I'm going out for a run to be fit. I'm going out to forage so I can get food. I was just going out because these things were fun, you know? And then suddenly like my rate of learning just went through the roof with it. You know?
Yeah, that's the playful state of mind piece, isn't it? So there's joy there.
There's joy there, yeah.
You know, and that heightens that expression. Yeah, there's so much there, isn't there? I think with the going back to that indigenous piece, because I often feel it, you know, it's how does this really look in nature? Mm. How does this feel in nature? So there's firstly, let's downregulate a bit. Let's start becoming more curious. And then really sensitive to an environment, like that light touch that we can have, leave no trace almost of that experience. Yeah. I guess there's also the piece of those needs being met by simply foraging. So there is a food need met, there's a movement need met, there's a play need met.
Yeah.
All of that. There's a conversation that I've been, Katerina and I bounced back, and I touched on it in my book, just touched on it, was this, the land nourishing us for what we need, like a real communication. Like if we were in an area, and even nomadic tribes, there is still this cycles within it, you know? And if you lived in an environment that's really, truly abundant, let's say, and you're really within the environment, you are the environment.
Mm-hmm.
That environment gives you, nourishes you what you need. And there's plants, for instance, lay down sugars into soil, sort of as enticing, then the soil then gives the plant what the plant needs.
Mm-hmm.
Animal, human included within that, then can eat the plant. Is there then a communication? This is my kind of curiosity. Is there a communication between the human, the plant to the soil to the plant to the human?
Mm.
So as well as the plant getting what it needs in the soil, is it then the human that gets exactly what it needs in the soil?
Mm.
And that's the sensitivity that I think we're missing often. And with the lab-grown kind of conversation that's coming,
mm-hmm.
what are we really disconnecting from in that sense, you know?
In that whole like kind of cyclical nature of it, you know, you don't, as soon as you start fiddling with a process that's on a global scale or a universal scale, you don't know what bits change, you know? We don't even have all the understanding and all the language to know, as soon as you start to move one piece of the puzzle, what knock-on effect that has, you know, like the realization that various fruits aren't grown or various vegetables aren't grown equal, you know, was like mind blowing for me, you know, when I realized that. I was like, how is one courgette different from another courgette?
Yeah, it doesn't look like that in a supermarket.
Exactly.
They're all exactly the same measurement.
Or even just like, how can a wild courgette or something grown in like someone's kind of back garden be different to the one in the supermarket, but they look the same? Like, I've just, someone just goes, that's a courgette. You know, the understanding that these can, the lives that these different like vegetables or courgettes have had in this instance can have different effects on your biology. It just sounded like mind-blowing to me, you know? But now I'm realizing through eating like more wild food that I think like, I mean, obviously we talk about how a lot of these kind of plant medicines from like a mushroom or cacao perspective, obviously there's a lot of wisdom in these plants and people have used these
in the DNA again, right?
Mm, yeah, exactly. But there's wisdom in the non-psychoactive plants as well. You know, I think just eating wild nettles, drinking wild nettle tea every day, that to me has had like a profound impact, you know? And I don't know what communication I'm getting through that. I don't have the language or really understanding of what that is yet, but there's a difference when I know if I'm drinking wild teas or eating wild food consistently, I feel up a different level of consciousness than if I'm just like eating food that I've bought.
Yeah, I feel there's more to the piece
because
we went down the rabbit hole of Steiner, like looking at the real papa of this biodynamics, looking at, you know, there's particular times when, even down to planetary alignment, when you would want to be harvesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we think about pre-Burn the Witch and our indigenous lands again, of knowing exactly when to harvest for true potency of what it would be we'd be consuming in terms of remedies or medicines in that sense.
Yeah.
If we talk about plant medicines, the exact time of when we should be doing that.
Mm.
You know, rather than just the tea bag with, you know, certain teas in it.
It's so much more than just what the object is or what the noun is or what the plant is. You know, there's so many other factors.
And then the intention of that, we spoke of intention earlier, like the intention of what you're foraging, but also imagine the intention of what goes into when we're planting and what the intention is when we're picking, then when the intention is when we're consuming. Yeah. Because even today, I mean, people have difficulty sitting around a table and just honoring the food, you know?
Yeah.
Thank you, plants. Thank you, animals. You know, thank you for the fruits.
Yeah, we're sick of that kind of language, aren't we? You know, because with the connotations that has, people are still quite uncomfortable with, you know, it seems like. But that's something that I've like noticed emerging in my kind of younger friend group even, you know, particularly if we're eating like animals, you know, that kind of, I don't know, to revere that life, to revere that being, you know, before you eat it, that's like definitely kind of, that's really starting to emerge in this almost kind of, I guess the reason that there's a restriction there is because of that religious connotation initially growing up, and kind of a lot of people I'm surrounded with kind of grew up in quite kind of atheist backgrounds, kind of getting rid of religion from their parents or their grandparents. And now that we're kind of realizing that this gratitude prayer element, particularly around food, is like, we don't want to miss that bit. Maybe we need to bring that bit back in, you know?
Well, it connects us to the bigger piece.
Mm.
Yeah. Even if it's just a connection to the lands of which you, have a light touch over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think with that grace piece, there's also, and that tuning into the land, being part of it, foraging is a real opener for that. Mm-hmm. And that piece again about the soils giving the plant and the plant then giving the human, for instance, what the human might need, and then the harvesting at right times even, and how much is involved with that if the suggestion is planetary alignment. I mean, that's like mind-blowing about where you could go with that, right? Yeah. But then there is the human need within that, and it's, I think, the difficult times to navigate right now is just the dogma that's within food, rather than us to get to a point where we are more intuitive. And I think the value in moving through a landscape, becoming the landscape, becoming sensitive to it and the seasons and eating with the seasons, is we start to really gain more skill within that of understanding what it is we need as an individual, rather than three people in this room right now and we're telling each other what we should be eating, which is a point of arrogance in a way. I have no idea about your biological system right now, of what you might need and what you might be lacking. And I think the more and more we get in tune with the environment and the sources of our foods as well, the better that understanding is for us individually of what we truly need, rather than the cages that we build around ourselves, perhaps with labels and dogma. I'm this, I'm that. Whereas I've now at this point where I'm a Tony.
Mm.
You know, and that can change from day to day. It could even change by hour of, wow, what is it I'm tuning into now? And I think going back to the supermarket, that's the danger. I think the heavily processed environment, the convenience of today, is really pulling us off the path of what we understand we truly need, because we've got highly palatable foods that are heavily manipulated, and that's steering us away from what those true needs are. Yeah. And then we have Instagram accounts telling us what we should be eating, and this specialist and that specialist. Again, how can they possibly know what you need? But I do feel there's a piece missing there, and I think that's...
Well, we're also foggy, aren't we? We're so out of tune that you don't even know how in tune you can be. That's the weird kind of story within my life, I realize, as I'm kind of going on a bit of a journey of learning who I am and waking up to various things. It's not that like... It was just ignorant. I just didn't know how good I could feel. You know, if you've never experienced what a day not feeling depressed is like, you don't know what happiness feels like. If you've never felt a day where you feel strong and healthy in your body, you've got nothing to compare it to. And if you've eaten processed food all your life and you've never experienced that mental clarity from not eating that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, alcohol was a big one of those for me. You know, from the point at which I started drinking as a teenager, from like, I don't know, 16, 17, I drank consistently probably every week, if not maybe every 2 weeks, until I was 23. And there was days and days would go by, months would go by, where I can't remember the time I hadn't drank, you know? And then I was like, knock this on the head. And then did dry January. That wasn't really a big deal. But then I went 3 months, and now I'm like, I'm not really drinking anymore. But I had no idea how clear I could feel. It took me about 3 months to realize how good I could feel with sobriety, because I'd never experienced it before. Mm. And I think there's so many cases of that within our kind of modern life, in our kind of processed life, that like, that's how it's been since birth. You don't know what it feels like to remove that processed thing. And once you do, you realize that it's way better than going back. You know, I now don't want to drink alcohol because I prefer being sober. It's just as simple as that, you know?
Yeah. Inherited templates again, right? It's again why it's so important to have, I think, younger generations there. Someone actually, there's this.
Yeah.
You know, open the door to this, because I had decades of that.
Yeah.
Boozing and doing drugs and didn't see another way. And then when it finally dropped in, like the huge eureka that comes from it, you know, this is what it's like to be human, you know? But I guess we also have to get to the point where we understand what's the empty space or the void I'm trying to fill with those drugs and alcohol. And for me, I really believe that the more I immersed in nature and natural practices, the less appeal it all had.
Yeah.
You know? So that sobriety piece becomes easier and easier.
Yeah, totally. I'm very similar. It allowed me to detach from the story, you know, to start wiring in a new story,
mm.
you know, a much more ancient story, basically.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, I couldn't agree more.
That's Sacred it. Sons.
Sacred Sons, yeah.
I was just thinking about the, you know, rewiring there.
Yeah.
How was that? Hold on, because I get it. You might still be integrating, right?
Yeah, I'm still integrating it, but it's... I just feel like a new person, you know? Like I... It's pretty much the most profound thing that I've ever gone to out of choice. I suppose maybe more profound things have happened at me. But, like, it's the first thing I've done where I've chosen to go to and been like, oh, wow, that lived up to what I hoped it would and more. Like, I didn't know really what I was expecting, but I kind of knew that I had to be there.
It's great. It's great to hear that because I again, social media, and you see Sacred Sons kind of content.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have become content creators, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we had it on the last 100 Human Experience we were holding, and we had someone there shooting. And although we're sensitive to it, it's for some, it's quite jarring,
yeah.
and they're having quite deep experiences. And then all of a sudden there's a camera there. So on this one, I've just said that we're not going to have any filming. Mm-hmm. It's almost like I have enough content. Let's actually see what the experience is like, how deep the experience is without having
mm-hmm.
Cameras. And so I guess that's really, it's a sensitive ground that it can be, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's great to hear that it marries up, right?
Yeah.
To what you see on their social account. Because it looks, I mean, it looks epic. Like completely,
I mean, their
social account
just doesn't do it justice.
There you go. Know? That's amazing.
Though. And reading people's reactions to those kind of videos, there's a lot of positive reactions, but a lot of the negative reactions that I've experienced just since sharing their videos over the last couple of days and doing collaborative posts and stuff like that, a lot of the negative kind of comments on that, the only way that I'd ever, not that I've responded to any, but the only way that I would have wanted to respond was that's like, you've just missed the point. That's just not what happened, you know? So you see these tiny windows and people can get quite uncomfortable by whatever's going on.
Mm.
But like what you see in that window was like 0.5% of what the whole thing felt like, you know? And out of context, these things can be quite jarring.
Yeah, and also what lens you're viewing it through, yeah. Already triggered perhaps by what you're seeing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, it was like phenomenal, you know, and it's exactly what I needed. You know, it was...
What was it you needed?
I needed eldership.
Yeah.
You know, I needed to not feel like I had to do, not to be, I always felt like I needed to be my own kind of guiding light, you know, and be like, I've always kind of been told I'm a bit of an old soul and like old for my age and all these kind of things. And although that's helped me in many ways, I also just want to be 24 and be allowed to be guided and to be an apprentice and to be the age that I am, you know, and I've felt largely devoid of real adults, particularly adult men in many ways, that I could look up to and be like, I want to emulate you. I want to do things like you're more me than I want to be in some ways, you know, not that I directly want to be these individuals, but like they're accountable. They show up, they do the things that they behind closed doors, you know, and they, I don't know, I just needed that. And that's the intention I went in with. I wanted to find that kind of thing, and it would filled my cup, overflowed my cup.
Amazing.
Know? Yeah.
Yeah, it's great, that elder piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we have a lot of elders, but not necessarily elders around us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a few elders that I kind of connect with.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really important piece for me. Also, just the accountability part is putting their hands up as well,
mm-hmm.
you know, and also help understand that we're always doing the work,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I think knowing myself when I was younger, it was very much like, it's now, I need it now.
Yeah.
And then thinking, oh, why is this not working? And there's the long game, right? Mm. There's the real embodiment of how long we stay in this practice. And for me, it now feels like, I guess we stop doing the work literally when we're pushing up daisies, you know, it's always work. There's always something there, you know, anyone in particular
there?
Yeah.
Matoska.
Yeah.
Who was, he's who I needed there, who I think was the oldest kind of leader there. he was an example of what an elder should be, I think, you know, and like it felt so weird to see that. It felt so foreign, you know, to meet someone who, like what we talked about, who embodied that wisdom, that wisdom of years and years and years and years and years of continuing to learn and show up and work on himself and be in service to others, you know. So he didn't just read something or listen to something or have one conversation that like sparked an enlightenment. It's like a lived enlightenment. Like he knows more because he's been around longer than me. That's who I need to be around, you know. Whereas a lot of older people I'd meet, I'd feel like just not that I couldn't kind of be guided by them at all. Like there was definitely things that I would look up to, but largely I'd be like, that's like so far out of the ballpark of the kind of life I hope I have when I'm that age, like 50, 60, 70, that like it was hard to really want to walk in that trajectory, you know. But to know that there are people out there who are kind of closer to that, it's just a relief.
Yeah, shining a light.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. It does come through embodiment again, because otherwise, I mean, how many podcasts, books, overwhelm with information, but the experience poor piece.
Mm-hmm.
Simon and I were discussing it earlier about ice baths.
Yeah.
And we had the Nat Life coach certification here. One of the guys in the circle has been a coach for years, and it came to discussing ice baths and how he's been showing up to the cold water, I think, for 5 years every day. 5 years, right? So we know through cold immersion and getting in the ice, or any point of discomfort that you revisit and revisit, you find comfort in it, but it's not to say it's not uncomfortable, you know? But there's the person that shows up, and there's the person in the experience, and there's a person that leaves the experience. So we could use the ice bath as an example. So approaching the ice bath, it's a different person every time, and all kinds of stuff drops in. And then when you're in it as well, you're dealing with the process and how you go through that process. And then when you come out again, it's a different being.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spoken to this in the past. It's like, I might not like the person getting in, but I'm in love with the person getting out, you know? So there's a transformation in that process, but by going every single day for a long period of time, you've been through everything within that practice. Therefore, you can speak to it from a real place of knowing, which is an embodiment, right?
Yeah.
And that's where the wisdom piece comes in, because I can read so much or view so much about ice baths, because again, on that lovely little screen we have, it's like, people want to post up their cold tub experience every time they're in there. But it's, well, what are we learning when we're in it, you know? Embodiment.
Yeah.
Which you're gaining lots of, again, when you're out there.
Yeah.
Which then means you can speak to it.
Yeah.
You know? And then it's real authenticity. Someone said to me, you know, Tony, the younger generation, you know, it's all they can sniff out authenticity. You know?
Yeah, I've heard that.
You know, so yeah. I think, again, there's so much engagement there on your platform, because it's coming from a place of knowing. Mm. There's authenticity within that.
Yeah. No, I went in with very clear intentions of why I was there, you know, and I've kind of written a manifesto about why I was there and like what I wanted, how I was going to use that platform. And because I was hypersensitive to inauthenticity and bullshit, you know. So I was like, well, if I go there and start adding to that pile, I have like, that's not who I want to be, you know. I'd rather not be there if I'm going to do that, you know. So going onto that platform with like, whatever I post, I kind of try and run it through certain filters, you know. But fundamentally, is what I'm posting encouraging someone to not be on their phone, or does what I post encourage another swipe? You know, could that thing infiltrate a young person's algorithm to make them go, wow, that thing's literally outside of my drive? Not like, look how amazing that thing is, really far away, not this crazy thing I can aspire to if I've made enough money or got the right kit or whatever, but something I could do like instantly, regardless of where I am, pretty much, you know. And that's why a lot of these plants that I like talking about, I don't really like talking about the particularly obscure ones. I like talking about what you'd consider like average garden weeds, kind of Herb Robert and dandelions and all these kind of things and stuff that even if you didn't live in Cornwall like we do, they grow out of the cracks in the pavement all over London, on verges in London, wherever you live, these things are trying to come through. They're trying to offer their wisdom to you. And yeah, you don't necessarily want to eat those things, but like engaging in a relationship with these like potent plants, you know, that have been consumed and dealt with, like dealt with kind of by your ancestors for, I don't know how long, but humans on these lands and all over Europe and now all over the world, you know.
Thousands like, and thousands yeah. of years. Yeah.
And just that, getting that ball rolling, it doesn't really matter where you are, you know. And I just wanted it to kind of be accessible and to make sure that anyone could kind of do it, basically. It felt like one of the few things that wasn't gate kept, you know, like although I'm not the most experienced forager, and it's something I'm still at the very beginning of and learning myself, I don't think anyone can gatekeep wild food because it's your birthright as a human. So for me to go on a dog walk with a friend and go, that's a dandelion, that's nettle, that's whatever, I don't have to be a master forager or a scientist or an expert to share that, because to me that is deeply human knowledge and wisdom that we are all allowed to talk about and all allowed to share. So that's why I was like, go ahead, just start. No one's gonna say you can't do that.
Well, how your journey started, right? In a short window of time. And yet it's as the season erupts.
Yeah.
Oh, there's another one. Oh, what's that? Okay, curiosity again leads to finding out what it is, and then that's embodied then.
Exactly.
You know? From the seeing it to the tasting it to the pooping it.
Yeah.
It's all there. What brought you to jumping on socials again, I guess? Because there must have been a big pause then, because it wasn't so long ago you didn't have a smartphone to being back on social, because it's quite a big thing. It's quite a commitment, right?
Yeah.
And so that means time. It means energy. And it's not like you're just throwing reels together. There's a process there, right, which draws on your other skills and expertise, which is fucking phenomenal, by the way. They're great. They are great. But that, again, it's the commitment. So what was the driver?
That I had to commit to something.
Okay.
You know, that as much as I didn't want to be part of the world of social media, because of the cultural landscape that I've grown up in, I was going to have to sacrifice something to get to the point that I wanted to get to, which was living more closely with the land in some kind of community way, in a way that doesn't even exist in my local periphery, you know? So I was like, to get from point A to point B, I was going to have to leverage some aspect of the modern world to get me there. And I investigated various avenues that I could have gone down, working for other people, you know, studying all these various things. And there's a lot of ways to kind of to get to that point. But I also really wanted my time. I wanted to be able to do things in my own way. And I was already a videographer, already had the camera gear, already had the editing software. And I was like, you could just try that. You could give it a crack. I know you hate it, but you could give it a go and you could try and see it in a different light. And I had a month off between video jobs. And I was like, just treat it like a job. Just if you don't like it after a month, you can put it down. And I did a bit of research on what kind of Instagram, what allows people to kind of blow up on Instagram. And that even that felt like a weird thing to be researching. I was like, I can't believe what I'm doing right now. Like, felt anti what I was about, to watch YouTube videos about how to get big on Instagram.
Yeah, but that also makes sense, because it's about being efficient totally, with your time, right?
But it was like exactly what I needed to do. I was like, it was a kind of a commitment to it, you know. And I was like, from what I read and watched, was that the algorithm, which is just another word for people, what people want is to be taught things. They want to learn things. And that's one of the things that gets promoted on social media, actual lessons. And it doesn't matter how small that is, but can you provide value to someone? You know, and that's what I really wanted to do. I reached a point where I was like, I want to provide value to my local and global community. And I don't know exactly how that looks, but I know that's what I want to do. So instead of directly looking at it from like a monetary perspective, I was fortunate to be making money in other ways. I was like, how can I just provide value and see what happens off the back of that? And did it for 2 weeks, and 2 weeks later I had 30,000 followers. And it's like, I was like, oh, it works then. Just do it. I was like, and I just carried on. And then now I've slowed down. But like, I just thought, commit for a month, treat it like a 9-to-5 job for a month, and every day teach someone something that you wished 16-year-old you would have learned from that platform.
Beautiful.
And people were starving for that kind of information. Absolutely starving for it.
And again, the void, right?
Mm. They want other kinds of things, you know, and like the kind of messages and comments I've had from starting it are just like, you know, I knew how deep the need for that kind of information was for myself, but it's like it's for everyone. We all need it so badly.
Also, it's free.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, it's like the practices I often speak to, out in nature, breath work, movement, play, they're all free.
Yeah.
And yet look how potent they are.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I guess it also helps seeing someone that's thriving,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's also very powerful, mm-hmm. you know. Reminds me of when I first started on Instagram. Didn't have such a huge explosion, but I'd been approached to do a book, and I didn't have many followers. I had 2,500 followers. It's even this. I didn't have many followers, but actually 2,500 people, right? And I'd been approached by publishers, and then I had a whole philosophy, and it was just this returning back to nature and what works in nature, again, bringing people back to the land and how they move and how they breathe and how they sleep, and looking at nature as the example rather than the huge bodies of studies that we have are from the human zoo or the laboratory. It's, well, yeah, those studies are great and that information is great, but actually, well, this is what works and has worked for thousands and thousands of years, right? So the publishers were keen, and yet I didn't have a large enough platform. So I had this amazing proposal to the point they were like, oh, this is amazing. We're getting the lead of marketing in here. We love this. And then it was, you don't have a large enough platform.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a period of time where I had screw this. I'm not doing it anymore. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of immature Tony in there somewhere that needed a bit of work, and immersed more in the practices to find that maturity to go back to it and see it as, okay, I need to treat this like a part-time job.
Mm-hmm.
It requires this. And if I have to get this message out in the world, and it's an important message, and I think it can truly transform lives, then I have to do the work.
Mm-hmm. And that's where people are.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's where you meet people.
That's where you meet people, exactly.
And you meet community.
Yeah.
You know?
And the opportunities and people I've met off the back of that has like changed my life forever, you know? And it's, I definitely don't think of social media as an all bad thing anymore. You know, like anything, you can, just depends how you use it.
Yeah, in the right hands, right? Yeah. With the right message and the skills that go with it. How are you finding the trajectory? Like the kind of,
it's pretty overwhelming.
5-month window.
Yeah.
To 123,000 followers.
Mm. It's overwhelming, you know, like, back on a smartphone now for like ease of life. For most of my life growing up, I've been someone who's been quite like anal about my digital space and like make sure that everything's neat and orderly, and I've responded to everyone. I've not left anyone on read, and I've like, it's almost like a room in my house that is completely spotless, and I've had to not do that. I can't do that with this anymore, because there's that many more people who reach out to you, and you just can't possibly respond to everyone. So that there was like a hurdle to get over there. Like I was like, wow, especially as that one video was blowing up, which is what changed my channel. And in pretty much overnight, I went from the old comment here and there to just like thousands of messages in my inbox. And I just didn't know what to do with that. And it made me want to throw my phone out the window.
You reached overwhelmed with it at that point.
Yeah. And then I just kind of rewrote the story in my head, basically being like, you can respond more, like we can respond with the videos almost. You can respond in like, not directly, but indirectly with just what you're talking about.
I think it's almost worth communicating to the audience. you know, because mm-hmm. it's like, it's your, say it's your community
mm-hmm.
and just speaking to it. I have thousands of comments in here, and you know, the idea is I want to connect to nature and mm-hmm. be in nature. That's what's connecting us really,
yeah.
is that message. So I'd like to answer as much as I can within videos, you know, mm-hmm. in within the reels themselves. I get it. It's a bit of a beast when that drops in, and then other platforms, and then emails, mm-hmm. then WhatsApp, and it's, wow, how can we yeah. possibly navigate all of that?
Yeah, suddenly I'm like on my phone way more than I was before.
I bet you're pleased though you're not Seth back there that was still consuming the booze,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Big time.
And that you now have practices where you can connect to nature and get grounded. It's mm-hmm. a much easier ride, right?
Way easier. And just like having the time away from the smartphone for a bit and to be able to come back with more mature eyes and all these kind of things, you know? And
yeah, I call it sky time over screen time.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So potent.
Exactly. No, I'm like a bit different person. Like my life's completely changed in the last year, you know. And like social media is the kind of the fruit of that, really. You know, it's all the things in the background that have happened in my life that have kind of brought that out of me and allowed me to mature, to be able to navigate that platform in a different way, and want to provide that value in that space and inject it with positivity into a space that I think is largely pretty full on, you know.
Wow, man, it's so good to hear from someone in their 20s, Seth. It really is. It's because again, it's, you're grounded, man, like properly grounded within it. That speaks volumes, and that's really inspiring, right?
Thank you.
I have someone that is in the music industry, mm-hmm. huge producer, some incredible artists, and it's almost like within that industry, for instance, that the burnout is like fast, it's rapid, it would seem, you know. And again, it's like, well, why aren't we thinking for this huge explosion? Imagine you're on, like, okay, let's just use X Factor as an example, mm-hmm. right? It's like you go from a kid busking to suddenly like blowing up, and yet no one around you giving you the tools and modalities to be able to navigate that, right?
Yeah.
And then of course we end up with mental health issues. We've got had that recently within one of the artists in the world, right? And it just seems such a travesty in a way. But again, I guess it goes back to the beginning of the conversation, right? Not being given the frustration there, right? Not being given, this is what you need to get your needs met.
Yeah.
You know, here's some simple modalities.
Mm.
So you're part of that now, right? You can actually speak to that.
Yeah.
You know, someone in their 20s maybe is straight out of uni, kind of like sleep in a mess and everything else, and it's like, well, here you go, this is all it takes, really.
But that's also because I've been fortunate, like because of that platform, people have paved the way, you know. I've kind of seeked that eldership and those mentors through that digital space, through the likes of your podcast and other people's podcast, and read people's books, and these kind of almost mythical figure of a parent or an elder or whatever is kind of, I've created one in the void of not having like a particular figure to look up to, you know, and taking the bits like through trial and error, kind of found myself where I am, you know. But like, it's like that, like the you basically have to go through like a testing period. If you don't have someone who is that real clear guiding light, you have to go through like a trial and error period where you go like, right, I'm going to take away that smartphone for a bit. I'm going to take away that alcohol for a bit. I'm going to take away these various things and see what life's like without those things. And you kind of become your own guiding light, you know?
Yeah, I think it comes back to that, the community piece for me, you know, like the several mothers, several fathers within that community.
Yeah.
Filling the void perhaps for mum's has this or dad has this going on, but that's okay, there's another dad there, there's another mum there.
Exactly.
And then that being, again, the observation of those templates, but I guess the templates haven't changed in those indigenous communities.
Yeah.
You know, there's no masks there. And then within our own communities, that feels like the piece for me. How do you see your do you have kind of an end game with the social media? Because for me, I feel like I'm working towards building community. So that we can fill that void of the several mothers, several fathers.
Yeah.
You know, so there is returning back to that, because we can't have the conversation about Indigenous and think it's just about movement and land and foraging without the community piece, because that's ultimately what enabled those Indigenous cultures to thrive, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because you can't do all these things alone. You have to live in relation. You have to be part of a, like, an interdependent web of not just people but all sorts of stuff, you know. And that is absolutely an end goal for me, you know. Like, I hope that my children grow up in that space. And now I don't know exactly what that looks like, but there's like a feeling attached to it. Like, I roughly know where that is and what that could look like, but I'm not trying to have too many strict parameters on that, because, you know, that could just happen in the town I live in. I don't necessarily even have to leave the house I'm in. You know, it doesn't have to be like everyone in a field living in yurts together for that to exist. You know, I think that at the moment, of course, there's this big move to kind of buy a house and a piece of land in the country so you can, like, grow your own veg and all that kind of stuff. And that's one model of self-sufficiency to me, and I've definitely considered that. But there's also the model of living in a town where everyone has smaller gardens and shares in a more local community, and you don't have to drive and everything is walking distance. And now I'm realizing that, like, what I thought was something I was trying to get out of, which is the town I live in, to get this, like, settlement where I can have this kind of homestead type life, I think for me, where I would thrive is actually staying in that town, but turning it into something that looks slightly different, and using the buildings that are already there and the infrastructure and the institutions and other things. Like, the bones of it kind of exist.
Yeah.
It's just about, like, re-injecting those places with life and people who actually want to be there, and not trick everyone into thinking that their life has to be this kind of crazy global thing where they're nonstop all the time, but we can come back, you know?
Yeah, pulling back to the multi-generational homes.
Exactly.
You know, which, if we lay blue zones on that, you know, it's the characteristics that are in that are the multi-generational homes, right? It feels like there has to be a bit of work done for that. You know, then that handing over of the baton from the elders to the younger, you know, for them to mature again and...
Yeah.
To seek wisdom within that multi-generational home, because that seems to be
that is the core of it.
Yeah,
that is absolutely the core of it. And, like, to be able to have close relationships with all the various people in your family that, you know, have proper deep connections with those people because you live with them, you know, and everyone relies on each other. For the older people rely on the younger people for various things. The younger people rely on the older people for various things. And, like, you know, there's a whole different dynamic when all these various ages are kind of cross-pollinate, you know?
Yeah.
And the cross-pollination of, like, the wisdom that comes from that, and the youthfulness to help the older people, and the wisdom to help the younger people. And, like, you know, that's the position that I'd like to be in, you know, where that can all kind of exist. But, yeah, I don't know exactly how to get there or what that looks like. I'm kind of slowly navigating it.
I don't think anyone does right now, right? Seems to be the piece. It's worth chatting to Bruce Parry about community, you know?
Yeah.
We're having a conversation way back, and we actually, off the bat, last, not this year's, but the year before, was Medicine Festival. And I remember arriving, and you go over a little bridge, and it brings you out into, like, the main stage area.
Yeah.
And I walked through, and, you know, there's people walking around naked and it had such a great energy around it. And I remember coming out of there, and I bumped into Bruce, and I was like, Bruce, amazing here, isn't it? It just really reminds me of just how it could be, you know, that real feeling of community. And he just said, Tony, it takes months to set this up, and it's gone in a weekend, you know? And then if you really unpack community with Bruce, again, it can be tricky, that conversation, because if I was to say, oh, I want to set up a community, well, then it's not a community. Yeah. It's I want to self-limit. Yeah, yeah. It needs to be the I would at least need to be interdependent I rather than independent I, you know?
And needs to come organically.
And needs to grow organically. Yeah. And that's largely why we sit and we say, I'm not sure how that would look.
Mm. Yeah.
Because we can't possibly. No. We'd almost need the forming of those people within the community first to then be able to sit and say, well, this is how it will look.
Mm. Which is why, for me, it comes back to like the day. What kind of day are you having? How are you holding yourself in that community? And like, because all you can do is control the things that you're doing. You can't be like, orchestrate the whole town to turn it into the community that you'd like. But you can be the person that maybe grows the vegetables in your garden and gives it to a neighbor. You can be the person who forages and gives something to someone else. You can be the someone who makes a roast and brings people around, creates groups in your local community that run together or fight each other or whatever you feel like you need to do, you know? And
I think it comes down to showing up, like truly showing up, like the authentic you showing up.
Yeah.
And that's where, again, the work comes in. Like you've been away to Sacred Sons, right? Mm-hmm. And practices like that you step outside even the community or the place that you're living to dismantle and deconstruct those limiting behaviors and beliefs.
Yeah.
And then when you come back, you've had another layer removed to get to the essence of who we really are, right?
Exactly.
And that would be a great starting point, right?
Mm.
Like the realization
takes a while that
we have to do the work, right, to be able to show up and be authentic in that showing.
Because we're infants in the sense of that, like because none of us have lived in the kind of communities that we're all dreaming of. We're infantile in those spaces, you know. Where so a lot of these communities start up and they realize that it's like there's a lot of problems there because no one's done any kind of inner work to be able to navigate that community. There isn't the kind of the generations of elders who can kind of keep the peace and kind of corral people to kind of make things less volatile maybe. And and there's so many pieces missing, you know. Yeah. There's so many things to add in, like, and I don't know how long that takes to like come about, but there's this amazing kind of, I feel privileged to be born at the moment to see it all happen again, you know. And there's a lot of pain there and there's a lot of difficulties to work through, but to be part of this kind of
it's fucking exciting.
It's really exciting.
That's what it is.
Yeah. To go through this remembrance process, to be like, because you have to forget to realize how good the remembering is. And we've gone through the forgetting process and now we're in this like remembering process. And it's going to look very, very, very different when I'm 80. If I get to 80.
Yeah. I mean, I've been going through that language of rewilding, reconnecting, this for years and years and years. And I've now arrived at remembering. I think that sums it up. And I think through that process as a collective, it feels that we're in a really important time right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can feel it, right?
Yeah, totally.
There's real change.
Massive.
But again, it's changing into what? Because again, it's a remembering.
Yeah.
So it's,
well, if we knew, we'd know and we'd do it. So we have to not know. And that's the point.
That's the point.
The point is not knowing.
It's scratching away and scratching away at the uncovering, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Of who we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're very, very fortunate to have kind of communities around the world who haven't lost a lot of their practices, who now are the wisdom keepers for us to emulate and not to directly bring back exactly what they do, but to offer a guiding light in how we could translate that into our own lands. You know, our kind of European and British indigeneity has been lost that many more years ago. The plant medicine that's associated with these lands, the food that's associated with these lands, you know, so all those kind of intergenerational kind of foraging wisdom and all these things that would have been passed down and that we've kind of lost, you know, we're hugely fortunate to have these communities around the world who haven't lost that. We can go there and you can ask questions and we can learn from to translate that back in our own life, you know.
Yeah, it's just it's holding on to that, you know. It's like 5% of the world's population are indigenous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Look after 80% of the world's biodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that piece.
Oh, really? Is it that much? Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so then we should be questioning, well, what what the fuck are we doing there?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What's the 95% doing? Oh, 20%. Oh, wow. Mm. I had a friend who was looking at visiting the San people.
Mm-hmm.
So he, with a romantic idea, of course, of persistent hunting, wearing sandals, the origin of sandals being a sand people, and arrives, and the pull of the West into their communities
mm-hmm.
means the younger generations are now navigating towards sugar, tea, mm-hmm. alcohol,
mm-hmm.
and less kind of inspired, let's say, by the elders within those communities, because mm-hmm. the pull of the West is drawing in. At the same time, their lands are shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
So even full persistent hunting, that's being reduced over mm-hmm. time, right? And naturally, there is this evolution within those environments as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So his project, and what I understand, is to shine a light on those kind of the elders and the indigenous practices that they have
mm-hmm.
in the hope that the younger generations see, okay, people are inspired mm-hmm. by this again, rather than their pull be this, rather than walk 100 kilometers, rather than persistent hunt, they're walking 100 kilometers to get sugar, tea,
mm-hmm.
tobacco, alcohol, all the influences that possibly pulled us off our lands.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
it's happening.
And it's no surprise, like it's like,
but it's happening again. Yeah, yeah. And there's like factory schools around the world. Mm-hmm. I did a bit of work, Survival International, and again, it's the same, that putting a cookie cutter schooling system within factory schools, and it's pulling the kids out of their traditions and out of their communities,
mm-hmm.
and almost indoctrinating them again. And then we get to see, that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if we want to be able to remember, it's we're now being shown this. You know, mm-hmm. we're actually seeing it in real time today.
Yeah.
Hard to even kind of imagine it's happening, but it is happening. So yeah, I think that's always been a big one for me. It's always, it's great shining a light on indigenous cultures, but we also need to amplify the voices
mm-hmm. yeah.
to protect, you know,
mm-hmm.
and give them space as well and yeah. celebrate them, you know, but with a sensitive touch. So it's not cultural appropriation, is mm-hmm. the real appreciation that comes mm-hmm. through, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, these are the people that know how to live on earth, basically
thrive.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. And it's like all these words like indigenous stuff get thrown around, you know, mm-hmm. and it can be used, people have varying opinions on what words are appropriate all the time, but fundamentally there are people on earth mm-hmm. who know how to live on earth properly, you know, in a way that doesn't damage their own health and the planetary health. And we don't now. We don't know how to do that anymore in many ways. So it's like we just rely, like we're relying on those guys. That's fundamentally true.
Yeah.
To learn that wisdom. And like, there's also no surprise why some of the younger generations of those communities don't like look at what happens in the West and go, I want a piece of that as well. You know, there might have to be that too. You know, it might have to be some kind of merging of the two. You know.
Yeah, that's what it feels.
Mm.
Yeah. Because at the same time, I was really inspired to get behind a documentary, because there's also the living museums that are there,
mm-hmm.
which then you would go and you can see how the San people would be living
mm-hmm.
in a living museum, except over here, this is like the reality check of what's happening.
Mm.
It's, you know, it's yeah. such an interesting
that's, kind yeah, that's of, pretty full on, isn't it?
Isn't it? You know?
Yeah, I'd never heard of that before.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at kind of doing something documentary wise, where it would mean spending time with indigenous cultures rather than a blue zone, something mm-hmm. along those lines. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe I need to have a chat with Seth. Right.
I'd love to be part of that. Sounds fantastic.
I'd love you to be part of that. There we go. We can pull on that interdependence again.
Yeah.
That'd be amazing. Because, yeah.
That'd be fantastic.
Again, kudos to the unique gifts and talents. Great to know you're in the community. We've been talking about community because it's taken, since moving here in November, we're nearly up to a year.
Yeah.
In the lovely Kern, Alfornia.
Mm-hmm.
But I said to Katerina, like, this is the year now that we've settled.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it takes time, right?
Mm-hmm.
To settle. To really work on the community. So part of that is my thinking of doing like gatherings, dinners, things like that. So it can bring people in who are in the community who are also doing great work, but also inspire others to maybe join, you know. So we'd love to have you around the table.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. I'd love to be around the table.
Yeah, man. Mm. Great to have you here, brother.
Yeah, thank you, Tony. Really.
Where can people find you?
They can find me on Instagram at You're From Here.
You're From Here.
Yeah.
Is it here or is it ear?
Ear, actually.
You're From Here.
Yeah.
You are.
Yeah, the letters you are, like text talk kind of.
Yeah.
From ERE.
Okay.
Yeah. That's me. And then I'm also going to be, my YouTube is going to be the next place. So you'll be able to find me there as well.
Is that just about to ignite that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're going to be on, is the same? You're From Here?
Yeah, it's going to be your, no, it's going to be You're From Here. Yeah. But it's going to be longer educational videos, more in depth.
Nice. Mm-hmm. I can see that. Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's where you can find Seth. Thanks, brother.
Thank you, Tony.
Great to have you. Let's have a hug. Come on. We're done.
Nice one, brother. You.
As always, I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you feel drawn to do so, then please subscribe to the show, leave a review, and don't forget to share. Sharing is caring. It really helps me to help others. If you're drawn to immersing yourself in any of the NatLife experiences or see yourself as a NatLife coach, head to tonyriddle.com for details of how to immerse yourself in the community. You can follow my adventures on Instagram at The Natural Lifestylist. Big shout out to Simon from We Are The Clarks for producing, filming, editing. Much love.